All right, good morning, everybody. I've got the microphone turned way up because I've got a frog in my throat today. So anyway, it might start acting a little strange. If it does, I'll turn the volume down, but otherwise you probably won't be able to hear me. Okay, a couple items we got to test next time. All right, so bring a good eraser and a pencil, Scantron, and you'll be ready to go. I can't remember if you need a calculator for this test or not. I don't think you do, but you might want to bring it anyway, okay? So that is Tuesday. And I reactivated a number of weekly modules in Blackboard because they were programmed to go away after the third test, but we haven't taken a third test yet. But that's just something strange about automatic systems. They work really well until something unplanned happens and then they misbehave. So I went back in there and activated them so everybody in all these sections should have all the study guides and everything you need, interactive exercises for these chapters that are going to be on the test on Tuesday. Okay, if they're not open for you, just give me an email and I'll open them soon, tonight or tomorrow. And sometimes I don't know how Blackboard behaves because instructors have different privileges set up in these computer programs compared to students. So sometimes what I see is different than what you see, but just give me some information on that. Okay, that's it. Oh, something else too. I almost forgot. And that is there is a class in here before hours, and sometimes the instructor likes to leave a little bit early, but sometimes he likes to stay in right until 20 minutes after 11. Okay, and sometimes he counsels students or whatever, and sometimes it might even be kind of confidential information or whatever. So he would just really like it if students didn't come in until 20 minutes after, right? Even though maybe it doesn't look like class is going on, maybe it's just one or two students. But anyway, he really would like to have the private time with his students in here before everybody else comes in and maybe distracts or inhibits the conversation that he's having with his other students. Okay. And so he promised me that he would give you guys a high sign when he's done. So if he's done before 20 minutes after, then the student will tell you guys to, okay, it's fine to come on in, or when he'll just, you know, yell out to you guys, it's okay to come in. So just to hold your horses a little bit until maybe 20 after. And I know my watch isn't set exactly, but so if you walk in early and somebody asks you to leave, just say, oh, I'm sorry, and I'll just wait outside. Okay, okay. All right, so let's see, we're still talking about endocrine chapter, and we did talk about this slide last time, but maybe we'll just go over it again. And I see a number of trophic hormones, or tropic, it can be pronounced either way and spelled either way. And what the heck is a tropic hormone? A tropic hormone is a hormone that, of course, it's transported by the blood, just like any other kind of hormone is, but it goes to another endocrine gland, and it causes the release of another hormone into the blood. So a tropic hormone target tissue is a gland, another endocrine gland, and it stimulates that endocrine gland to release its hormone, a different hormone, and it probably also causes that endocrine gland to grow, or it keeps it from atrophying, from going away. All right, and the proper levels, what this diagram right here shows you, that the proper levels of various hormones are controlled by feedback mechanisms. And what is the most general, what's a feedback mechanism that usually leads to a nice, healthy state that maintains homeostasis? Yeah, negative feedback, right? So that if the stimulus increases, then some kind of mechanism is going to have some kind of negative effect that's going to subtract from the stimulus to bring it back down toward the set point. Well, that happens in a lot of cases. Let's look in this particular case right here. We have the hypothalamus, and it has receptors for numerous hormones, and it's going to release trophic hormones to the anterior pituitary. How are these trophic hormones going to get to the anterior pituitary? Well, as a matter of fact, the question would be, how does any hormone get to its target tissue? Via the blood, right? And this particular circulation is pretty fancy. It's a portal circulation. So you have a primary capillary bed in the hypothalamus, and it goes through a portal vein to the anterior pituitary, where there's a second capillary bed, so that hormone, the releasing hormone, can diffuse out and then stimulate the anterior pituitary to release other hormones. So the hormone from the hypothalamus is a trophic hormone, right? Because it's causing another endocrine gland to release hormones. In this particular case, it's going to be gonadotropins, and there are two, FSH and LH, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone. You should be familiar with those acronyms, what they mean. And these are gonadotropins. These are trophic hormones because they're going to cause another endocrine gland to secrete a hormone, namely either an ovary or testes. It's going to secrete sex steroids, right? And so female sex steroids would be estrogens and progesterones, and male sex steroids would be androgens. A good example would be testosterone. All right, so how do we maintain proper concentrations of these things? Well, since they're floating in the blood and the blood goes back to the anterior pituitary, here's a short loop feedback, right, and will feed back to the anterior pituitary, causing its decrease in release of gonadotropins, right, because it's a nice negative feedback. But it also feeds back to the hypothalamus as well, which then decreases the amount of GnRH that's going to be secreted. All right, so the proper levels of these sex steroids are maintained in the blood. Your book also mentions another one, that under certain circumstances, there can actually be retrograde blood flow from the anterior pituitary back into the hypothalamus. So gonadotropins, FSH, and LH, right, will decrease GnRH secretion from the hypothalamus directly. That's another form of a short feedback loop. All right, so but there are many feedback loops, short and long. Now, this system is kind of interesting because in women, right at mid-cycle, there's a positive feedback. So instead of having a nice negative feedback here where GnRH inhibits the anterior pituitary, it actually stimulates the release of LH. Right, so if high concentrations of LH, then feedback and then stimulate the release of more LH, which then feeds back and causes a release of more LH. So you have a very high concentration of luteinizing hormone, and that signals ovulation in the ovary. And then as soon as the ovary ovulates that egg, then the physiology of that structure of the follicle drastically changes, and it is no longer sensitive to LH. And as a matter of fact, it stops secreting estrogen and starts to secrete progesterone. In the very last chapter, we'll talk about that some. So these feedback loops can change from positive to feedback depending on certain circumstances. Okay, who's got a question about short loop or long loop feedback loops? When we get to the reproductive chapter, I'll have to talk a little bit more about that, how things switch around a little bit. All right, so we talked about this. I'm not sure we got to the posterior pituitary, but posterior pituitary releases two hormones, and of course you should know all the hormones that are released by the anterior pituitary. And the mode of release is a lot different. It's just a nervous mechanism, a neuronal mechanism. The tissues in the posterior pituitary are not glandular in nature, right? They're nervous. It's part of the nervous system, so there are nervous tissues in there. As a matter of fact, there are axons and axon terminals. And when a nerve impulse reaches the axon terminal, it causes the release of secretory vesicles, and these secretory vesicles contain antidiuretic hormone or oxytocin. So these really aren't neurotransmitters. These don't cause EPSPs or IPSPs in neighboring nerve cells, but these are signaling molecules and that get picked up by a capillary bed in the posterior pituitary, delivered all over the body. And then if there are receptors to these hormones in some tissues, they become target tissues and change the physiology of some of the cells in your body. In particular, ADH, or antidiuretic hormone, has a target tissue of the kidneys, and it causes the kidneys to resorb water or retain water or take water out of a fluid that will become urine and take that water and put it back into your bloodstream, right? So that's how you conserve water. So it will produce a very low volume of very concentrated urine, so your body will retain water. The other hormone is oxytocin, and oxytocin is a smooth muscle stimulant, and it causes contraction of smooth muscles, particularly of the uterus, which is handy for parturition, but also the smooth muscle of glandular tissue of the breast if it has been prepared by prolactin during gestation, and it will cause the milk letdown reflex. All right, so what kind of cell releases oxytocin? Is it a glandular cell or is it a neuron? Yeah, it's a neuron, right? So oxytocin is a neurohormone, and since the these cells are neurons, they can be involved with nerve reflexes, right? So it can be a very, very fast reflex. And the milk ejection reflex, for instance, starts off with a stimulus with a infant nursing on the breast. And of course, those action potentials go to the brain and they're shared with the hypothalamus, and then the hypothalamus integrates that information up and it releases oxytocin. Okay, so that's a nice neuroendocrine reflex. Okay, so how do these signals get from the hypothalamus? Here are the two nuclei, the paraventricular and the supraoptic. I'm not sure if I'm asking you to know which hormone comes from what nucleus, but this is where the hormones are produced in these nerve cell bodies. And then they're translocated down to the axon terminus where they're stored. And they're only released when an action potential reaches the axon terminus. And via exocytosis, then they're released into the bloodstream. Okay, so the paraventricular, right, makes oxytocin, the supraoptic makes antidiuretic hormone, and then they're stored in these axon terminals. So here we have some myelinated axons going through the infundibulum or the stalk of the pituitary down into the posterior pituitary. So what do we call white matter in the central nervous system? It's a tract, right? So that's a tract, and it's got a name because it goes from the hypothalamus to the hypophysis or pituitary. This is called the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, or sometimes people call it the hypothalamic hypophyseal tract. But of course, in anatomy, you can combine terms together as long as you do what? Put a little O between them. All right, so if there's an O, you don't need a hyphen, but if you say a hypothalamic, then you probably need a hyphen between those two terms. So it's just a tract that goes between the hypothalamus and the posterior pituitary right here. All right, so make sure you know what hormones are released from the posterior pituitary and which are released from the anterior pituitary, and you've got a couple of really nice exam figures to help you remember that information, right? Okay, and the functions of those different hormones. Okay, so let's go to the adrenal glands. And the adrenal gland might be a little similar to the pituitary, because remember, the pituitary has two major parts. It's got the anterior and posterior part. One is nice glandular tissue, and the other is nervous tissue. That's the pituitary. And the adrenal gland sort of is that way as well. It has some complexity. The adrenal cortex right here is a lot different than the adrenal medulla. And you could think of the adrenal medulla as being neuronal tissue, okay, and the adrenal cortex as being a true endocrine gland. So it's going to secrete different kinds of hormones. So if we look at a histological section right here, these first superficial layers right here is what we define to be the adrenal cortex. Remember, the cortex is just some superficial part of any kind of organ in your body, and the deep part is the medulla. So the kidneys have what? A cortex and a medulla. The adrenal glands have a cortex and a medulla. So we see three different layers in the cortex, and the adrenal medulla is pretty much all nice and homogeneous. And these cells down here in the adrenal medulla are what we call chromaffin cells. So what are we going to talk about first? Oh, the adrenal glands. We're going to talk about both, I guess, on this slide right here. The medulla. Okay, those chromaffin cells synthesize epinephrine and norepinephrine. Where have we run into norepinephrine before? Where have we heard about norepinephrine? It's a catecholamine. And where is it normally released? Where have you learned that it is released? What's it used as? Yeah, it's a neurotransmitter in the sympathetic nervous system, not parasympathetic, but in the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, well, there's a molecule that's very similar to it, and that's epinephrine. And the medulla will secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine as a hormone, which means what? When the medulla secretes it, where does it go? Into the blood, and then it goes everywhere, and then it can bind to receptors, adrenergic receptors, anywhere in the body. All right, so in this particular case, epinephrine and norepinephrine are acting like a hormone, but those chromaffin cells are really modified neurons. They don't transmit electrical impulses, but they receive innervation from a preganglionic sympathetic fiber. So when they're stimulated by the preganglionic fiber, they automatically just release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood. They don't transmit an electrical impulse someplace. So in this particular case, epinephrine and norepinephrine are really acting like neurohormones. Okay, and that just increases sympathetic tone all over the body, and that's going to enhance What kind of mechanism? The rest and digest mechanism or the fight and flight mechanism? Yeah, the sympathetic, right? So that's going to increase your heart rate, your pupils are going to dilate, it's going to increase force of contraction, probably cause a little vasoconstriction of some blood vessels so that your blood pressure increases, and it will inhibit digestive processes because when you're faced with a stressful situation, digestion is not a very important process, right? Okay, but blood flow to muscles is, and good blood flow is. All right, so that's the job of the adrenal medulla, to increase sympathetic tone all over the body by releasing these catecholamines. The cortex, on the other hand, is not innervated, but it does receive information from the pituitary gland because that's where ACTH comes from. What part of the pituitary gland releases ACTH? Yeah, the anterior part, right? So ACTH is a trophic hormone. It causes the cortex to grow, but also to release a couple classes of hormones. Cortisol might be an example of a glucocorticoid, right? And cortisol inhibits glucose utilization, and it stimulates gluconeogenesis. So it increases blood levels of glucose by decreasing utilization. So glucose has trouble getting into cells, but it also causes cells to, what, make more glucose. So glucose concentration increases in the blood, which kind of sounds like what kind of disease process? What happens when you have high glucose in your blood? Like diabetes mellitus, right? So cortisol right here does increase insulin resistance, which kind of makes like a diabetic state in people. Okay, this other hormone right here is a mineralocorticoid, and this is aldosterone, right? Because it works on sodium and potassium, not glucose, so it's a mineralocorticoid, and it stimulates the kidneys to resorb sodium but secrete potassium in the urine. So it causes you to, it spares sodium loss but increases potassium loss. All right, so you might have a question on aldosterone sometime in your life, maybe on a board exam, and it's going to ask you about, well, which way does sodium go and which way does potassium go? Does it help you maintain potassium levels or does it accelerate the loss of potassium from your body? And the same thing for sodium. And notice what's the relationship between sodium and potassium as a result of aldosterone? Do they both go in the same direction? They're different directions, right? So the answer on your test most likely will be the one that says, well, sodium goes one way and potassium goes the other. Okay, so it's a really easy way to figure that one out. Okay, so aldosterone, we're going to look at that mechanism quite a bit in a following chapter, in a cardiovascular chapter. Oh no, renal chapter, in the kidney chapter, which is one of the last chapters. Okay, and the adrenal cortex also secretes, as a result of ACTH stimulation, right, that's a trophic hormone, sex steroids. And in particular, it's going to be male sex steroids or androgens, something like testosterone. But generally, androgens are a general class of male sex steroids. Okay, and of course, that's very important in females because which sex or which gender typically shows the most aggressive behavior? Yeah, I would say females. In what respect? I would give you a good example. Like protecting young. Right, so the maternal behavior in protecting young. What kind of bear do you never want to walk up in upon in the woods? Yeah, one that is protecting their young. Okay, and that's due to these androgens that are in their circulatory system. And androgens in females are also necessary for sex drive. And of course, we can't have a population of any kind of species without sex drive, right? So that's why they're there in males and females as well. Okay, so here we have the different compartments of the adrenal cortex. Okay, you have the zona glomerulosa, and then you get the fasciculata and reticularis deep to that. I don't think I have any questions regarding the histology of the adrenal cortex, but you should know that there are different layers, and these different layers produce different kinds of compounds. Like the most superficial produces mineralocorticoids, aldosterone that we just mentioned. All right, and the precursor, and that's a steroid, so the precursor molecule for aldosterone is cholesterol. You should probably be aware of that. Okay, and then the glucocorticoids, two examples here, corticosterone and cortisol, are producing the deeper layers of the adrenal cortex. But, and these are what kinds of compounds? Are these like protein hormones or amino acid hormones, amine hormones? These are, we'll look at the precursor molecule, it's cholesterol. So these are steroids as well, right? So these are steroids, right? So how do these work? By a genomic action, right? So they have cytosolic receptors. They can act as transcription factors and increase protein synthesis in cells, which then change the physiology of the cells. Okay, they don't have surface receptors. And then androgens are made in the deeper layers of the adrenal cortex as well. And again, that's a steroid, so the precursor molecule is cholesterol. So I'm sure you've heard a lot of harmful effects of cholesterol, but of course you have to have the proper concentration of cholesterol. Otherwise, you're going to be missing what? All of these steroid hormones in your body. Okay, you don't want to have too much cholesterol because that can produce arterial sclerosis, which is a vascular disease, and other heart diseases as well. Okay, the adrenal medulla, let's just review that a little bit. The two hormones are norepinephrine and epinephrine. It's mostly epinephrine. And in the circulatory system, epinephrine lasts a lot longer than norepinephrine. So if you're driving down the freeway and all of a sudden you're involved in an accident and it looks for sure you're going to die, right? Your heart is going to be stimulated by this epinephrine, and even if you're lucky enough to live through that episode, your heart is not going to calm down in a minute or two, right? It's going to have an elevated heart rate and force of contraction for 30 minutes, maybe even an hour, because this epinephrine isn't degraded as fast or as rapidly as norepinephrine is. Okay, so the adrenal medulla is innervated by preganglionic sympathetic fibers. Right, so these are the myelinated fibers that come via splanchnic nerve to the adrenal medulla. And this increases sympathetic tone all over the body, activating the fight or flight response, increasing respiratory rate. It's going to vasodilate bronchioles, increasing heart rate, and force of contraction of the heart, which is going to increase cardiac output, which increases blood pressure, so that blood has a tendency to flow much more rapidly to all different parts of your body. There's going to be a vasoconstriction, and that's going to increase blood return to the heart. So as more blood returns to the heart via veins, then the heart has the ability to pump more blood. So cardiac output goes up again. And metabolically, it causes glycogenolysis. Ooh, what does that do? So epinephrine, as a matter of fact, we look at the two kinds of receptors, both alpha and beta receptors, adrenergic receptors in the liver. Glycogenolysis is, that's what was on a previous slide, that's going to increase blood glucose concentrations, right? It's going to break down glycogen, especially in the liver, and that glucose is going to end up in the blood. So that's a nice energy metabolite. And lipolysis does the same thing, right? So that produces amino acids for beta oxidation to make ATP. And it can even make some glycolytic intermediates because it produces glycerol, right? Do you remember what the building blocks of a triglyceride are? It's the three fatty acids and a glycerol, right, which are important energy molecules. Okay, so that's the adrenal gland. Thyroid gland. It's sort of in the news lately. Okay, and here is the larynx. So here is the thyroid cartilage. This is the largest cartilage in the larynx, and sometimes you call that, what, an Adam's apple. So here is the thyroid gland, kind of a butterfly-shaped gland. It has two lobes, but it's connected with this tissue right here. We call that the isthmus. And it has three hormones associated with it. One hormone is what we call thyroxin, and thyroxin has a couple different forms. One is tetraiodothreonine, and the other is triiodothreonine, and T3 is the active form. Okay, and these hormones right here set basal metabolic rate, but these are also needed for growth and development, right, during development. Yeah, the thyroid gland has to be proper. The thyroid gland also releases calcitonin. I'll maybe say something about that in a little bit. And also embedded in the thyroid gland are some parathyroid glands in each of the wings over here that release parathyroid hormone. So those are the three hormones in this area right here. The parathyroid glands you should really know is a separate gland from the thyroid, but they're embedded in it, so if you want to consider that right now, that would be okay. Okay, so in terms of thyroid hormone, it's produced in follicles, and a follicle is a spherical structure, right? So it's a ball of cells, and it has an empty interior, or an antrum, and that interior is filled with what we call a colloid, and it's a protein-rich fluid, and it's kind of sticky and gooey, all right? And the cells on the outside will secrete T4 into the colloid, and there it will stay, bound to these proteins. Because thyroid hormone is sort of like a steroid hormone in that it is hydrophobic, right? So it really has to associate with other molecules that act as a detergent to get it to dissolve in water. So here is a follicle. You can see the ring of cells on the outside, and here is the antrum on the inside filled with colloid. And these follicles actively transport iodide that's in the plasma, right? So you can have really high concentration of iodide inside the follicle and low on the outside because it's transported in by active process. Now, why is that sort of relevant today? What's in the news lately? Yeah, radiation, because nuclear power plants do produce a radioactive form of iodine-131, right? And since the thyroid gland actively transports it up, even if there's low concentrations of radioactive iodine in the environment, it's still going to have a tendency to concentrate inside the thyroid gland, where then it can undergo radioactive decay, and those high-energy particles then can kill these cells right here or damage the chromosomes to where these cells become cancerous, right? So thyroid cancer is one of a prevalent kind of disease process that happens with radioactive iodine exposure. But there's one really nice thing about radioactive iodine, okay, and that is it doesn't last very long. It doesn't last for millions of years in the environment. It doesn't even last for thousands of years. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even last for 100 years or even 1 year, okay? It only lasts for about 8 days and then it disappears. But during that time, if it's in your thyroid, it can cause those problems. So it's a very short-lived threat. So I'm happy to report that anyway, right? So there is, that's why people were interested in getting potassium iodide pills, because they thought that they could competitively inhibit the uptake of iodine. If you have a lot of normal iodine, then maybe the thyroid gland won't take up as much radioactive iodine, but I don't think it's ever been shown clinically to have any kind of effect, right? So I probably wouldn't run out or go down the internet and buy some regular potassium iodide. Nonetheless, the thyroid gland needs iodide to make an active form of thyroid hormone. Okay, so iodine is actively taken up by this follicle, and then it's oxidized, all right, and into iodine, and then it's combined with tyrosine to make triiodothreonine or tetraiodothreonine, and then these are bound to the thyroglobulins inside this follicle right here, and then that can be it can be unbound from thyroglobulin, and it can be secreted by the follicle due to levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone. So thyroid-stimulating hormone will cause release of T3 and T4 from the thyroid gland. TSH will also cause the thyroid gland to grow and produce more follicles, right? So the thyroid gland can grow. So TSH is really a tropic hormone causing the release of another hormone, but also causing hypertrophy of the thyroid gland. Okay, and where does TSH come from? It comes from the pituitary, in particular the anterior pituitary. And how does the anterior pituitary know to release TSH? Because, the hypothalamus tells it to. How does the hypothalamus tell the anterior pituitary to release TSH? Because the hypothalamus releases TSH, RH, right? And then it goes through the portal vessel, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vessel, to the anterior pituitary that causes release of TSH. Okay, so what do we have right here? Here's a nice control mechanism for the release of T3 and T4. So these come from the thyroid gland. They're released in the presence of thyroid stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary, and that the hypothalamus controls it by secreting TSHRH, or you could say just TRH. All right. And as the concentrations of T3 and T4 in the blood increase, this feeds back to the anterior pituitary, then closing off the release of thyroid stimulating hormone. All right, so this is a nice negative feedback loop, maintaining the proper levels of T3 and T4 in the blood. Okay, but let's consider a circumstance where there's plenty of tyrosine in your body, so you can make some precursor molecules to T3 and T4, but you don't have iodine in your diet. And you can't make iodine, that's just an element. So if you don't have iodine in your element, the thyroid gland cannot make a competent triiodothreonine or tetraiodothreonine. So the compounds that the thyroid gland is making aren't really the hormones that it's being requested to make. So if T3 and T4 decrease in the blood, then what about this negative feedback loop right here? It goes away. Right, so there's no negative feedback, so the anterior pituitary is going to release more thyroid-stimulating hormone, and that's going to cause the thyroid to grow and to make more T3 and T4. So it's going to secrete a lot of product, but it's not going to be competent because why? There's no iodine to make it competent, right? So there's going to be low T3 and T4. There's going to be very little negative feedback to the anterior pituitary. There's going to be an excess of thyroid-stimulating hormone, and that's going to overstimulate the thyroid gland. So it's going to cause hypertrophy of the thyroid gland. So instead of being a normal small shape, right, it's going to be very, very large. And as a matter of fact, it could almost be as big as two fists in somebody's neck right there. And of course, that's really easy to treat. How would you just treat that? By giving iodine in the diet, right? And we get it in the United States mostly because of salt, right? Because salt is laced with iodide. Okay, so when the thyroid gland hypertrophy is like that, that's what we call goiter. But there can be another case for goiter as well. This, I think, might be this probably is an exam figure too. Okay. Well, let's go to the parathyroid gland. I don't know, I don't have a picture of the parathyroids, but let's go back to a thyroid gland. This is like an anterior view of the, thyroid gland. And the parathyroids embedded in the posterior surface, there are four of them. And the parathyroid glands are important for regulating blood calcium levels. And so it's not really part of the thyroid gland, but it's really closely associated with it. So when there's a decreasing blood calcium level, right, then the parathyroid sense that. So this is under what we call humoral control, right, because it's just measuring the amount of this chemical that's in the body. The parathyroid glands release parathyroid hormone, and there are two target tissues for parathyroid hormone. So if there's decreasing blood calcium, what do you think the effect on bone is going to be? To demineralize bone, right? So it's going to promote what kind of activity? What kind of cells are going to be activated? Osteoclasts or osteoblasts? Osteoclasts, right? Break down bone. And when it breaks down bone, it produces this soluble form of hydroxyapatite, and that increases calcium in the blood, right? And that feeds back, of course, this is what? Opposes what the initial stimulus is, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. It also has an effect on the kidneys, so parathyroid hormone goes to the kidneys and it causes the resorption of calcium from urine. So it increases blood calcium that way, decreases calcium loss in urine, and again that opposes the initial stimulus. That's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Now, blood calcium levels are very important to control, right, for synaptic transmission. That's one thing that we learned about. And it's also what, an important second messenger in a number of transduction schemes. And the catecholamines was one that we just looked at recently. But you're going to also see that calcium is very important for muscle contraction, cardiac, smooth muscle, and skeletal muscle. So this is a very important parameter, physiologic parameter in your body. And what is one way that you can have very precise control and balance of a parameter? What kind of control mechanism, if you were going to design something, what kind of control mechanism would you design? if you like, all very good, like an antagonistic mechanism, right? Like sympathetic and parasympathetic control, or extensor muscles and flexor muscles, right? So it seems kind of futile, but you need to have antagonistic mechanisms to have precise control and balance. So parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium, and since that's such an important parameter in your body, there is a hormone that is responsible for decreasing blood calcium, and that comes directly from the thyroid gland, and that is called calcitonin. So calcitonin decreases and parathyroid increases, and then when they work together, even though they're antagonistic, you have the proper levels of calcium in your body. Okay. Well, what's another chemical that should be closely regulated and maintained within homeostatic range in your blood besides calcium? Okay, insulin's a hormone, but I'm thinking of a metabolite, not necessarily a hormone. But it's related to insulin. Okay, as a matter of fact, yeah, I'm thinking of glucose, right? So you're on the right track and reading my mind. That's great. So if you want to have proper, nice, precise control of glucose in the blood, guess what kind of control mechanism you should have? Antagonistic control again, right? Okay, and that comes from the pancreas. The pancreas is sort of interesting. Here it is right here. You see that it has a number of ducts in it. So what does that mean when you see these ducts right here? What kind of gland is it? It's an exocrine gland. Oh, but what's the title of our chapter? Endocrinology. So it just so happens that the pancreas right here has a part exocrine function, because you see these ducts carrying digestive enzymes through the small intestine, but it also has endocrine parts, right, that release hormones directly into the blood. So interspersed throughout the pancreas, there are what we call little islets of Langerhans. These are like almost little follicles that contain other kinds of cells that do not produce digestive enzymes, but hormones, right? And it's an endocrine gland because these hormones are not transported by a duct, but they're just absorbed by capillaries around these little islands right here. And there are two different kinds of cells. You got alpha and beta cells, and they secrete two different kinds of hormones. All of these cells right here have receptors for glucose. So again, this is what we call a humoral regulation or stimulation of endocrine control, because glucose directly affects what these alpha and beta cells do. All right, and these alpha and beta cells are going to produce opposite effects on blood glucose. The alpha cells secrete glucagon, right, in response to low blood glucose. So what do you think glucagon, what's the effect of glucagon on blood glucose concentration? If it's secreted when glucose is low, it's going to subtract from that stimulus, right, and increase blood glucose by glycogenolysis. Oh, what the heck is glycogenolysis? It's breaking down glycogen into glucose, right? And if that's in the liver, then the liver can secrete that glucose into the blood. And lipolysis as well, that breaks down triglycerides into fatty acids, okay? And glycerol, via what, gluconeogenesis, can make even more glucose. All right, so glucagon elevates blood glucose levels. And you should probably know what cells in the pancreas do that. Those are the alpha cells, right? Alpha cells in the pancreas. All right, well, since glucose is such an important physiologic parameter for us, because it kind of regulates how much ATP your body can make, okay, there is an antagonistic hormone to that, and you're familiar with this one, I'm sure, and that is insulin. It is secreted and synthesized by beta cells. It responds to high blood glucose levels. All right, and insulin, remember, is just a passport that is necessary so that glucose can enter most cells of the body. Okay, not all cells, but most cells, especially muscle cells. And we looked at that mechanism once before. So how does insulin work for promoting entry of glucose into cells? Okay, insulin, first off, what kind of molecule is it? Is it hydrophobic or hydrophilic? It's an amino acid type of hormone. It's not a steroid, so it's a hydrophilic hormone. So where are the receptors? So if it's hydrophilic, it dissolves in water, right? So what does that mean in terms of the plasma membrane? Can it get through the plasma membrane? It cannot get through, so the receptors are on the plasma membrane, right? They're not cytosolic. So there's a receptor on the extracellular side of the membrane, and when it binds insulin, what happens? What happens? It signals a bunch of metabolic pathways that will take an endosome that is inside the cell that has facilitated transporters for glucose, and it takes that vesicle, the endosome, and lets it fuse to the plasma membrane. So now those GLUT4 transporters are in the plasma membrane of the cell instead of being in the endosome inside the cell. And when those transporters are in the plasma membrane, that allows for facilitated diffusion of glucose from the extracellular fluid into the cell. All right, so that's how insulin works for promoting entry of glucose into the cell. So it only works by facilitated diffusion. There still has to be high glucose outside the cell and low glucose inside the cell. But once glucose gets inside the cell, right, if insulin promotes the conversion of glucose into glycogen, and pretty much any time glucose concentration goes up inside the cell, right, it's converted into glycogen, and it can also be converted into fat as well. Okay. And when glucose leaves the blood and enters cell, what happens to the concentration of glucose in the blood? It decreases, right? So that's why we say insulin decreases blood glucose and glucagon increases. So if the stimulus is an increase in blood glucose, there are cells that are going to be particularly sensitive to that, namely the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas, right? And they're going to directly release insulin into the blood, and these insulin is going to travel everywhere in the body, but it's going to bind to receptors in those target tissues, and it's going to increase cellular uptake of glucose, right, which will decrease blood glucose, which subtracts from the initial stimulus right here. Okay, and it's the opposite effect compared to glucagon. So we see then that promotes the formation of glycogen and the formation of triglycerides when glucose concentration increases inside cells. All right, so I think we talked about two real important hormonal mechanisms that are antagonistic to each other. And so you should probably be able to tell me what hormones are antagonistic to each other. As an example, like insulin and glucagon, and what else? Having to do with calcium regulation. Calcitonin and parathyroid hormone, right? Okay. Now, some people were thinking of sympathetic hormones like norepinephrine and epinephrine, but there is no analog in the parasympathetic nervous system to that, which is kind of interesting. Okay. Which probably is a reason why hypertension is a problem, as well as diabetes mellitus, because there's nothing that really counteracts the effects of those sympathetic hormones that are in the blood. So that's kind of a design flaw, probably. All right, so that's it for the endocrine chapter. Anybody have any questions on endocrine? So this probably is an exam figure or something close to it. You had a figure like this in chapter 1 that was even better because it included glucagon as well. So did I pass the sign-in sheet around for today?
Yep.
Yeah, I think I did. Good. All right, so that's all the information for the test. And I don't know if you came in late. I did activate all the weeks that disappeared maybe last night because I guess I was thinking there was going to be a test a couple months ago, right? All right, so all those weeks are reactivated, but I'm not ever going to turn them off because it's a pain to go in there and reprogram Blackboard. So when you log on to Blackboard toward the end of the semester, remember, those weeks are still going to be there, but just look at the period of time and read the chapters. So if you've already done it and been testing on it, you don't have to do it again for the final. All right, they're not going to disappear. Okay. All right, so that's it for endocrine chapter. And I think that takes us to muscle. But you guys know a lot about muscle already, so I probably don't have to say too much about muscle. But there's some interesting things. So maybe just a little bit of review on muscle. Okay. So we're going to start talking mostly about skeletal muscle. All right, so here is a nice skeletal muscle. And what does muscle specialize to do? To contract, right? All kind of muscle, the only thing that it's specialized to do is contract. It does carry action potentials, all right, but it's not for transmitting nerve impulses, right? Those action potentials are designed to stimulate muscle contraction. All right, so what kind of membrane proteins does a muscle have to have in order for it to transmit an action potential or develop an action potential? What kind of membrane proteins? In order to have an action potential, what do you need? An action potential is some kind of voltage in action. It's changing, right? What are the two parts of an action potential? I guess you're not being tested on that. That was last test. What are the two basic parts of an action potential? Oh, you had to draw this in lab even. I mean, it goes loop and then loop. What's the first loop? That's depolarization, okay? And what's the second part? Repolarization. And how does it depolarize? Tell me something about depolarization. What do you know about depolarization? Sodium enters the cell. Now, sodium, if I remember correctly, is an ion, which means that it has a charge on it. So it doesn't like to go through the membrane, right? And it's a cation. It has a positive charge. And so since it can't go through the membrane, I think you're pulling my leg. I don't think it enters the cell. How does it enter the cell? It can't get through the membrane. There's an ion channel. As a matter of fact, oh, I see. Now, is that ion channel open all the time? No, it's closed, and it opens. How does it go from closed to open? Depending on the voltage across the membrane, right? So a voltage-gated sodium channel opens up. That causes depolarization, and then repolarization is caused by a voltage-gated potassium channel that opens when the membrane depolarizes, right? And when you have a positive charge like potassium that's inside the cell and it leaves, what happens to the voltage inside? It becomes more negative, and we call that repolarization, right? Okay. All right, so muscle cells, all right, or muscles, where's my cursor? Ooh, way over here. All right, so muscle cells have voltage-gated channels for sodium and potassium, so they can transmit action potentials, and it's a signal for contraction. All right, it's not necessarily for transmitting information, but just a signal for contraction. All right, so a muscle is designed only to contract. And since this is a skeletal muscle, what's it going to pull on? When something contracts, it can only pull. So muscles can only pull. They can never push on something. What is it going to pull? It's going to pull a couple bones closer together. And so there's got to be a muscle-to-bone connection, which we call a tendon. And you should know the basic chemical compound and the tissue that a tendon is, right? Which is what? Just dense, regular connective tissue. And the chemical compound is collagen right there. Something that we usually don't talk about, but it's kind of interesting because people injure dense, regular connective tissue all the time, tendons and ligaments, by stretching joints the wrong way or muscles. There is a vitamin that's necessary to make collagen. Anybody know what vitamin it is? So that if you ever damage a joint or any kind of connective tissue in your body, you got to make sure you have that vitamin in your diet because you can't make it yourself. The hint is that it's a water-soluble vitamin, which means your body can't store it, so you should have it in your diet every day, and probably even elevated levels when you're trying to rebuild tendons and ligaments, and that is vitamin C. Vitamin C is necessary for your body to make proper collagen molecules. I'm sure all of us maybe have talked to a doctor at one point or another about a sprain or something. Okay, so this is the fascia that's surrounding the muscle that's continuous with the tendon, which then is continuous with the bone right here so that this muscle can pull on the bone. But there's other connective tissues as well that are continuous with the fascia right here. So if we have a nice transverse section of a muscle right here, we can see there are various compartments within the muscle. And so sometimes we call these muscle bundles, or we could call them fascicles. Right, so that is one building block of a whole muscle. We have fascicles. So there is connective tissue that surrounds the whole muscle that is just deep to the fascia right here. We call that the epimysium. Mesium just is what? A muscle membrane. Epi means on top of, that surrounds the whole muscle. There's another kind of connective tissue that separates all of the different fascicles out from each other, right? And we call that the perimysium, right? And as we get to the end of this bundle of a fascicle, the perimysium fuses with the epimysium, and the epimysium just kind of fuses with the fascia, which then fuses continuous with the bone, right? So they all pull on each other when these muscles contract. And the building block of a fascicle are individual muscle cells. And these muscle cells are really, really long, right? They kind of look like a fiber, a thread or something. So another name for a skeletal muscle cell is a fiber. And, you know, they're kind of strange because a muscle fiber is a cell that has many nuclei in there. And typically for a cell, how many nuclei do you think most cells have? Yeah, just one. So at some time during development, there were progenitor cells that we call myoblasts that fused together to form this really long cell right here. Okay, and as a result, since a muscle fiber is the fusion of many cells together, then those nuclei, right, just stay in the same cell. They don't regress. So a skeletal muscle fiber has many nuclei. And I'm not even sure how many nuclei it has. I've been trying to find out, and no one has ever hazarded a guess yet. It could be, most of the references I look at say there's several nuclei inside every muscle fiber. Okay, but there's probably hundreds or maybe even some that are thousands if it's a really long cell. So that meant that what? There are hundreds of cells that fuse together to make this really big, long fiber, right? And around every individual, if we pull out this fascicle right here, we see the building block is a muscle cell or a muscle fiber, and it has its own connective tissue sheath around it, and that's called the endomysium. And at the end of the cell, the endomysium fuses with the perimysium, right? And that fuses with the epimysium, and then fuses with the fascia, and these things all just pull together when this muscle cell contracts. Okay, but we're not done looking at the structure of muscle just yet. All right, so we can pull out an individual muscle cell. Here it is zoomed in. So make sure that you can show me or describe the whole structural organization of muscle. Right, what's the basic building block of a muscle, like the biceps right here, is the fascicle. Fascicles are made of cells. Okay, and then if we pull out a cell, we see even some more tubular structures right here. So we're getting down to almost a molecular level to understand how a muscle contracts. And these are the organelles of contraction. So these things right here, you should consider organelles. Here's another organelle. Here's a nucleus, right? And muscles, of course, are loaded with mitochondria as well. These things are what we call myofibrils. So the myofibril is the organelle for contraction, and that almost completely fills up the sarcoplasm, which is the inside of a muscle cell. So all of these are myofibrils. And then if we look at pull out a myofibril, we see that it even has some fine structures associated with it. And I can see a pattern within the fiber itself, and this is due to the arrangement of these proteins inside of a myofibril. They all line up exactly together, and it produces that striated appearance. All right, so the proteins inside a myofibril are what we call filaments. All right, so that is almost the smallest structure that you have to be aware of. I think in anatomy that was. All right, but you had to know that there were how many kinds of filaments? There are basically two, right? There's thick ones and thin ones. The thick ones are myosin. The thin ones are actin. Okay. So basically two kinds. There's some other proteins inside this myofibril that we'll talk about too, which may be, it's not on the next slide. But what is on this slide right here is that the cell membrane of a muscle cell, it really isn't called the cell membrane, it's called the sarcolemma. So anytime you hear this term sarco, you should probably think of skeletal muscle. Okay, and don't forget that they are multinucleate. Now why is the muscle fiber multinucleate? Because at one point in time, it was not just one cell, it was what, quote unquote, several cells, probably thousands, right, that fused together. And what were those cells that made a muscle cell called? Those are myoblasts, right, myoblasts. Okay. Just like an osteoblast is what? It's a cell that makes a osteocyte. It makes bone, right, and then it becomes an osteocyte, a mature bone cell. Okay, so blast means something that's used to derive a mature cell line. Okay, so here you see skeletal muscle, long and linear. Do you see any branches in skeletal muscle? No, they're just big long tubes filled with myofibrils. And all the myofibrils have the myofilaments all lined up in just the right way so that it forms these striations. right? Even if you look from one muscle fiber to another, it still almost looks like all of these striations line up together. All right, so how does muscle know when to contract? Because it has a somatic motor neuron going to it. All right, so how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to skeletal muscle? It just has one, right? And an autonomic outflow pathway has two. That's why I mention it, because autonomic nervous system is on that next test, right? All right, so there's one motor neuron that goes all the way from the spinal cord to a muscle. And at the end of this axon terminus, and these are all nice myelinated nerve fibers, right? Here is the axon terminus. And it's sort of like a regular synapse that you're familiar with, okay, a neuron-neuron synapse. When an action potential reaches the terminus right here, that opens some calcium channels, so there are voltage-gated calcium channels, which then cause the release of neurotransmitter from these synaptic endings right here. And that neurotransmitter then causes EPSPs on the skeletal muscle, which is excitatory. What is an EPSP? How does an EPSP work? It produces, it opens what, a sodium channel, right? And the neurotransmitter in this particular case is acetylcholine. And so the receptor type at the neuromuscular junction is just your typical nicotinic type cholinergic receptor, right? Which opens up a channel, and predominantly sodium enters the cell, which causes depolarization, okay? Now the difference between the neuromuscular junction and a regular synapse between two neurons, right, is one, there's a big physical difference, because when this muscle cell, okay, is excited, what happens? Something drastically different compared to when a postsynaptic neuron is stimulated. What happens to this muscle cell when it's stimulated? Yeah, it's going to contract, right? So it's going to want to pull away from this motor neuron right here. And so there are special adaptations in the neuromuscular junction, right, so that this motor neuron cannot pull away from a muscle when it starts to contract. So that's kind of, that's one major difference, right? So you see actually the insertion of the axon terminus into the sarcolemma right here. And we call this specialization the motor end plate. There's something else that's different. In a dendrite, okay, a dendrite has those nicotinic receptors which open up sodium channels. Right, so that is just what kind of channel is that? We talked about a voltage-gated channel, but what is a channel that needs a neurotransmitter to become a ligand-gated channel, right? So on nerve cells, on dendrites and cell bodies, you have ligand-gated channels, but does a dendrite and cell body, can an action potential ever be developed on a dendrite or cell body? It can't, right? So some people are shaking your head, that's great, but it's probably real important to know why. What's the molecular reason for that? Because dendrites and cell bodies have ligand-gated channels. They don't have voltage-gated channels, right? So you need voltage-gated channels for action potentials. Now, here's the big difference in the neuromuscular junction. Underneath the motor end plate, there are not only ligand-gated channels that depolarize that depolarizes the cell when acetylcholine binds to them, but there are also voltage-gated channels. So as soon as this motor end plate starts to depolarize because of ligand-gated channels, what automatically happens, right? It's not just an EPSP that starts up and then fades away, but an action potential starts right away, okay? Because there are voltage-gated channels in this region as well, which is a lot different than dendrites in the cell body. Hopefully you can have a little picture of that, okay? So another thing then about a skeletal muscle is that when a nerve impulse reaches the neuromuscular junction, what always happens to this membrane right here, because it has voltage-gated channels that open up? Action potentials are always initiated if it's a healthy muscle, right? So when a skeletal muscle receives information from a motor neuron to contract, what does it always do? Can it sit there and say, no thanks? No, it can never make up its own mind, which is different than smooth muscle when we start talking about smooth muscle, because in the neuromuscular junction, it has those voltage-gated channels. It just automatically depolarizes, which then causes contraction. So skeletal muscle can't really ever make up its own mind. So those are the specializations of the neuromuscular junction and this motor end plate right here. It has those voltage gated channels in it. All right, and that's a good thing because skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. If you tell it to contract, it just should. It should never say no thanks. Okay, a motor unit is defined as a motor neuron coming from the central nervous system, and here you can see in the ventral horn cell bodies of this nice multipolar neuron, and it leaves this root. Oh, can anybody remember the name of this root right here? Okay, this is the ventral root. Remember, and over here is the dorsal root. So dorsal root is the afferent root, and the ventral root is the motor root. So here it comes out, and it follows this a nerve to the muscle. And then there can be many bifurcations, many axon terminals going to a number of different muscle fibers. So here is a big muscle like the biceps brachii that has thousands and thousands of fibers to it. So this motor neuron won't stimulate the whole muscle to contract, just these right here that form a neuromuscular junction underneath this axon terminus. Okay, but that's okay, but I see another motor unit over here going to different muscle fibers. All right, so a motor unit is defined as the motor neuron and the number of muscle fibers that it innervates, right? So that's usually a ratio of 1 to 100 or 1 to a couple thousand. Okay, so here you see a nice zoomed in area. Here's one motor neuron, and how many muscle fibers are innervated? 3. So this would be 3 to 1, right? So not very many of these muscle fibers contract when there are nerve impulses on this somatic motor neuron. Now when we say somatic, ooh, what does that mean? That means voluntary, means body. Somatic means to the body, the surface of the body. And what kinds of muscles do you mostly have on the surface of your body? Skeletal muscles, right? So, and those are voluntary. So in that sense, somatic has the connotation of being voluntary, right? Because it's going to the surface of your body. Okay. So when a motor neuron is activated, all those muscle fibers in the motor unit contract, because muscle fibers can't make up their own mind, right? And the number of muscle fibers in a motor unit varies according to the degree of fine control capability of a muscle. So there's some parts of your body where you need a lot of dexterity. There's other parts where you don't need very much dexterity at all. So the number of motor units will change. So for instance, on your face and on your hands where you want that very fine control, then you have a lot of motor units, but the innervation ratio, which is what we call the number of motor neurons to muscle fibers, right, is very small. So that you need a lot of impulses traveling down a lot of motor neurons to various motor units to have fine degrees of control or contraction in a certain part of your body, like your hands and your face. Another part of your body that doesn't need a lot of fine control but still has a lot of muscles are your back, for instance. They're important postural muscles, right? But you don't do a lot of fancy things with your back. Don't use it for communication or anything like that. So the innervation ratio is relatively large, 1 to maybe 2,000. Okay, so fine control occurs when motor units are small, like one motor to just maybe 100 or so muscle fibers. All right, so this explains something, because a muscle fiber, when it's stimulated through the neuromuscular junction, it just automatically reaches threshold because the ESPs are very high and there are voltage-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction. So a muscle fiber will always contract to 100% of its ability. Okay, so a muscle fiber will either contract or not contract, sort of like an action potential, right? It's an all-or-none response. But you kind of know that when you tell your biceps to contract, it doesn't always contract with 100% of its capability to do that, right? Because otherwise, probably you'd be punching yourself in the face all the time, right? So you can pick up very light stuff like a piece of paper. So how is it that if a muscle fiber contracts with 100% of its ability, how is it that you can grade contractions? How is it that you can produce weak contractions? Okay. And it's a concept right here that we call recruitment. Okay, so when you visualize an object, okay, your brain has an idea how heavy it is, and it works with the cerebellum to activate just the proper number of motor units that will develop the tension to lift that particular object. So if it looks like a bowling ball, you're going to know to use a lot of motor units to lift something heavy, right? Or maybe a battery in your car. But if it's going to be a styrofoam ball and you know it's styrofoam, then very few motor units will be activated. So just a few muscle fibers will contract, producing what, a weaker contraction, so that you can lift something very, very light. All right, so the brain estimates the number of motor units required and then stimulates them to contract. And you can fool that system, and maybe you have, unintendedly. Maybe you've been to a restaurant sometime, right, and you just sat down and somebody brings a platter over with a bunch of mugs of water, right, and they put them down on the table. And you go, oh yeah, I'm thirsty. So you grab one of these mugs, okay, really heavy glass mug, and you lift it up, and then all of a sudden it goes, whoa! It's like you almost throw it on whoever is sitting next to you, because it's not a glass mug, it's what? It's a plastic mug, which is really, really light, right? So your a priori information was a little wrong. You thought it was heavy, you activated a lot of motor units, but in effect, you didn't need so many motor units. But fortunately, since you have a nice cerebellum right there, you know that's a totally inappropriate action, and you catch yourself before you spill that water all over the place. All right, so recruitment is important for grading the strength of muscle contraction, even though a particular fiber will always contract with the same force. All right, so I think we can talk about this a little bit for today. So here is a muscle fiber. All right, so here is, what is this, right? What is this membrane on the outside of the cell? Not the cell membrane itself. Oh, you know what? They don't have it here. I only see the cell membrane. All right, cell membrane is the sarcolemma. The cytoplasm is the sarcoplasm. And on the outside of the sarcolemma, there is connective tissue. What is that connective tissue that's on the outside of every cell? What was that? How about endomysium? Endomysium? Okay. And then we have organelles for contraction. What did we call organelles for contraction? Myofibrils. And there are even proteins inside myofibrils that are myofilaments, and that special arrangement of myofilaments give skeletal muscles the striated appearance. And the two basic kinds of myofilaments are actin and myosin. Okay, so here we see a repeating unit. I see one really thin, really dark line right here, and then another really thin dark line, and it's repeated all the way from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. This thing right here is the structural and functional unit of contraction. All right, so I know we've used this concept a lot in here. Like, what's the structural and functional unit of life? That's a cell. You break the cell down into its basic components, and now you have a much better idea how life works or how a cell works. And what about what's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? The synapse, right? And now you know all the little pieces of a synapse, so now you have a pretty good idea of how a synapse works. Well, the same thing for muscle contraction. We want to understand all the pieces of this sarcomere and how it functions, and then we can use that, right? If we just add a bunch of sarcomeres together, thousands of sarcomeres together in a line like that, we'll see how this whole muscle contracts, right? But notice even on either side of a myofibril, there are even more myofibrils. So all we have to do is really understand one myofibril, and we're going to see how they all function together. Okay, so you see some bands, some dark bands that go from over here to over here, all right? And a dark band is called an A band. And then here I see a light band, and a light band is called an I band. And it's not really called that because of it's dark or light, although it matches up really easy for you to memorize. The dark band is the A, because there's a nice A in dark, right? And the light band is the I band. It had to do with other properties of light, but this works for our class. The dark bands are dark because we have the thick filaments there. So here we have a bunch of myosin molecules, and the light bands don't have any myosin, they only have actin. So the endpoints of a sarcomere are these really thin, super dark lines. And what's the last letter in the alphabet? Z, right? So these were just called the Z discs or Z bands, because remember, this goes through the whole myofibril. It's really a disc, not just a line, but it's a disc through this three-dimensional structure, because that demarcates the end of a sarcomere. And the end of one sarcomere is then what? The beginning of the next, right? And the end of this one is the beginning of the next one. So all of these are, all these sarcomeres, you can think of as being glued together. And the thin filaments, where are the thin filaments attached? They're attached to the ends of the sarcomere, the Z-discs right here. Notice that the myosin molecules are kind of floating on the middle inside of the sarcomere, but they're connected, okay, with some proteins in the very middle right here. We call that the M-line, right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. Okay, so when we come back after the test, we're going to really talk about the structure of these myofibrils and look at muscle contraction. Okay, that sign-in sheet is going around someplace.